Welcome into the Towel Boys, our first episode in June. He's Mike Vermala over at RunRevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection, and somehow we have a lot of stuff to talk about, even though it's early June and there's nothing going on. But we're going to talk about Rashad Vaughn and Chris Wood because their draft stocks are going in opposite directions, although they're at very similar spots according to a couple different mock drafts. Also going to talk about basketball and non-conference scheduling as a whole in the Mountain West, since Craig Thompson basically said they want it to be they want to put requirements in or restrictions in. Also talk a little bit about recruiting, and then we're going to talk some football. I am going to compare Randall Cunningham to Blake Decker, and I don't I know how it's going to go.
As football players, you're comparing them?
Yes. Yes, okay. As football players, as quarterbacks, since Randall Cunningham is on the Hall of Fame ballot as a punter. I don't think Blake Decker has done any punting, so that's not quite fair. But as quarterbacks, yes, and I don't know. I found it interesting, so we'll see. But we'll start with the NBA draft and UNLV's chance at having two guys in it. Mike, it's early June. The draft's in late June, not early July, right?
Yes, yeah, June 26th.
Like the 25th.
Yeah,
26th.
Like,
okay. So we're like less than 3 weeks away. If I told you UNLV has one guy drafted in the first round, which one is it going to be?
I think it's Chris Wood. He's the guy that was there all year. I feel like draft night size usually wins out on draft night.
So, Draft Express has had Rashad Vaughn rising and Chris Wood falling. As of this recording, Rashad Vaughn was going 25th to the San Antonio Spurs, while Chris Wood has fallen all the way to 28th, which is Boston. So, basically, Rashad Vaughn has moved up about three-fourths of a round, like 20 picks. Well, Chris Wood's fallen. What was his highest? Did he peak at like 18 or something?
I thought he got up into the high teens at one point during the season.
So he's fallen quite a bit in terms of the first round. Not based on workouts or anything after the season, but based on what we saw from them, why would you think Chris Wood is falling?
It's going to take him a while. Like, he's probably 20 pounds at least away from contributing to an NBA team in any meaningful way. All you have to do, you have to turn on the TV and see the kind of guys that are playing, like in the finals that are going on right now. Like, Chris Wood is not anywhere near earning minutes for either of those teams or really any kind of playoff team. He's his body just needs so much development. Like, how quickly is he going to put on, 25 pounds of muscle? And he's just a long way away physically.
As far as Rashad Vaughn goes, do you think Rashad Vaughn is the more ready NBA player of the two?
I think Vaughn has skills that will translate more quickly. I could see Vaughn carving out a role earlier just because he can shoot. He's got size for a shooting guard, and he can hit from three-point range. So if he's healthy, I could see him earning minutes, a handful of minutes for a team that needs shooting or a team that is, wants to develop him. Whereas Wood, if you're going to play him, that's like just probably going to be a defensive nightmare for the first year. If you want to play him as a rookie at power forward in the NBA, that's probably not going to go well on the defensive end for the first year. So I see Vaughn probably cracking a lineup before Wood.
The thing that's bothered me with Chris Wood in terms of trying to translate what he did in college to the NBA on the offensive end is, like, when he caught the ball on the block, he had so many times where he, like, didn't really make a post move and just sort of twisted his body, like, as he jumped or sometimes before he jumped and, like, banked it in.
Yeah.
And he was able to do that because he was 6'11", and a lot of times, like Air Force, they didn't have a guy that was very tall that could do anything to alter his shot, so he didn't have to make a post move. He didn't have to do anything to get around long arms. He just kind of stood up, and he was taller than everybody. And I, like, I've seen him in practice work on post moves and drop steps and spins, and like I've seen him physically do it in practice against a manager with a pad, but I haven't really seen him do it in a game, like against anybody on a consistent basis. So I know he can physically move his body to do that because I've seen it in practice, but he catches the ball on the block in a game and he just doesn't do that. He just is like, well, I'm just going to kind of shoot it regardless of where my body is facing at the moment.
Yeah, that's something we talked about during the season, how he was working on his post game, but still a lot of his post moves consisted of, you know, just out-athleting guys, you know, just jumping higher and putting it in the basket however he could. But it wasn't consistent, but I will say that I did see some stuff in the post that can translate to the NBA. There were a couple times where he caught the ball on the baseline, a quick spin, one step, explode to the rim. And I think I said it before, like the thing that's so tantalizing about Wood is he makes that move, and he doesn't just get past the guy. He makes the move, and he's at the rim dunking because he's so long, and he can jump for a guy that size, and he's got the athleticism and the body control that he's not just making moves, but he's making moves, and he can finish in there. Is he going to be able to do that at the NBA? He's going to take a lot of work. You can't do that once every 2 weeks. You can't make one move every 2 weeks. You've got to make it, you know, you've got to do it every possession, every game. You've got to get your skills to that level, and then he's got to get his body to that level where, you know, once he makes the move, you know, Draymond Green can't just, you know, knock him off of his spot with a forearm. You know, he's got to be able to match up to those guys physically.
Draymond would need less than a forearm.
But
if it with Chris Wood and offensively, is he? I think right now you give him the ball 15 foot face up, he'd be able to do decent against some NBA guys facing up and trying to drive past him. But that's really, I think, all he has right now that would say, okay, he can put the ball in the hoop in the NBA. Do you think it's more important that he develop some sort of post up game, or that he show, hey, I can knock down an NBA 3-pointer at 33%.
I probably see him as an athletic stretch four, like a stretch four, like a guy who plays power forward, not so much in the post, but is face up, like mid post, putting the ball on the floor, stepping out, shooting jumpers. Best like a if you want like a shoot for the moon comparison, someone like LaMarcus Aldridge, like that type. Guy who can knock down mid-range jumpers and can also take it in the post when it, you know, the matchup is favorable. So I mean, that would be like the kind of player you would, I think, would be the easiest route for him to develop if you wanted to sort of tailor him and develop him that way. I think that would be easier and more conducive to like his skill set than, you know, planting him in the post and telling him that, hey, you're a banger now, you're going to score with your back to the basket, we want you to be, you know, Jahlil Okafor, that's, you know, that's what the type of prospect we want you to be. I think I think that the way the NBA is going, like, that's the more natural route anyways.
I agree, because you see the Golden State Warriors have Draymond Green as their center in overtime of the game one of the NBA Finals. So I do think that the better he becomes as a shooter is, in terms of offense, probably the most important thing he can gain or work on or whatever that would make him a quality NBA player. So looking back, though, at UNLV from this aspect, and I've mentioned it on here, and I wrote about it a little bit too, and I have some theories to answer this, but the question has been asked, how did UNLV go 18-15 and 8-10 in the Mountain West with two first-round draft picks or two top 40 draft picks, whatever it ends up being? And I've got a couple different reasons, but Mike, how did they go 18-15 with two of the top 30 players in the draft?
Well, first I would say two first-round picks projected, yes, but they're also, you know, two of the last handful of picks in the first round projected. You know, it's not like these guys are going to be lottery picks. It's not. These guys are at the top of the draft, and also these two lottery picks are 18 and 19 years old. Like, they're one was a freshman and one was a sophomore who had very little experience. And Rashad Vaughn was playing, it seemed like, from what we're hearing now, was playing injured for most of the season, and then had his season ended early because of another injury. So I think it. Just because you have two first-rounders, that doesn't automatically mean that your team is going to make it to the Sweet 16. A lot of things still have to work in your favor. You can't just put two talented guys out there without any regard for anything else that's going on in the court. What's your theory?
So the first one, I think, is injuries. And I'm just looking at the 18 conference games. Injuries and depth as a whole, because you had Kendall Smith transfer out early, and they came in with Seegers and Carter having to be redshirted as is. But if you take the season from when Rashad Vaughn got hurt, they lost Vaughn. The very next game, they lose Dantley Walker, and they were down to, you know, seven guys for the last part of the season. I look at this in terms of injuries. If Rashad Vaughn doesn't get hurt, they probably beat Air Force at Air Force. They lost that game by one. Now, Chris Wood hit a three as the buzzer expired, so it was a four-point game until then. But they were never, like, out of that. I think they win that game if Rashad Vaughn's healthy. And then they lost three games from that point, close games, home game to Boise State, home game to San Diego State, and the Mountain West tournament game to San Diego State. If Rashad Vaughn and Dantley Walker stay healthy, I don't think it's ridiculous to say they get one of those three games against the top two teams in the conference. I think they very easily could have gotten them without him. I mean, they were in all three of them. So if they had Rashad Vaughn, maybe they get one there. So I think those injuries cost them one or two games at the end of the year. But the bigger thing to me is if you take this team and you look at their points per possession differential, they were fifth best in the Mountain West, and in only conference games. They were fifth best in the Mountain West. They finished seventh. They had a positive points per possession differential when they were an under 500 team. They had a better differential than Fresno State and Wyoming, two teams that finished ahead of them. So just on a per possession basis and an efficiency basis, UNLV was a 10-8 or 11-7 Mountain West team. They should have been. But they lost a lot of close games. They had a lot of one-point losses. They had, I think it was, five games that they lost by 3 points or less, plus the Boise State game, a sixth one that they could have won at the buzzer in regulation before losing by nine in overtime. They only lost one game by more than single digits, and that was when they got run out in the second half at Utah State. They lost a lot of close games. They lost them late, and I think some of that was fatigue because they had a short rotation, but I also think they were not a good defensive team. And what was the – they had a streak there early in conference play where it was like opponents in the last, you know, seven possessions were scoring five of the seven possessions or six of the eight or the last four possessions. Like they had a streak where they were not getting a stop in the last 3 minutes of games. And so to me, if you just took them as a whole points per possession differential – they were the fifth best team in the conference, and they should have won two or three more Mountain West games based on that. And so I look at it, and I'm sitting here, I'm saying this is a team without injury, and if they could have played the last 2 to 3 minutes like they played the first 38 in every game, you're looking at 3 to 5 more Mountain West wins, which is anywhere from 21 to 23 wins. So to me, that those are the two explanations, is injuries and short bench overall cost him a game or two, and then just not being able to finish on the defensive end. Like, it wasn't offensively. Like, they were fine offensively. They even had a great play that got him into overtime against Utah State and got him some late baskets in some games as well, but they just couldn't get a stop defensively in the last 2 minutes, and I think that's the biggest reason why they were 18-15. And if they could have gotten those stops, it might have been a 21-22 win team.
Yeah, and I think that the defensive stops late in game speaks to the fatigue and also probably the experience. If you buy into, you know, experience mattering and, you know, in sports, then I would assume that's when it would manifest itself, is in the final minutes of a close game when you need to buckle down and, you know, get a defensive stop. And you have to hit your rotations and, you know, play it perfectly and make sure you get the stop. Like, that's when it would rear its head.
When we talk about next season, and I've kind of mentioned this before, that this team, they didn't win last year, so I'm hesitant to say, you know, they're going to win next year. But at the same time, like, I look at it and I say they were pretty efficient offense. Their defense was not good, but at the end of the day, they were more efficient. They were a positive in terms of efficiency, and they should have won more games. do you put a lot of weight into that, into that this team was, they were net positive in terms of efficiency, and that, you know, scoring points per possession is a very good indicator of a good or bad team. Like, do you put any weight into that in terms of next year saying, well, last year's team wasn't as bad as their record said, so our expectations probably should be a little bit higher?
I think that a lot of it, based on personnel, a lot of the success that they had per possession can carry over, because I think they've done a pretty decent job of replacing the guys that are leaving. I think they've got credible answers in both of those spots. And like, I wouldn't expect like a huge drop off. The biggest difference is going to be just looking at the roster from last year to the projected roster for next year. It's just the depth. Like, they have literally twice as many players that can be competing for spots. Like, last year, there were times when injuries got bad. Dwayne Morgan was starting, or he was a sixth man. That's the guy, when I was doing the roster projections, it's like, there's like, you can see a scenario where he's like the 11th man on the team next year.
There were moments last year where it was like, should Dave Rice give the walk-ons a few more minutes to keep his guys fresh? Like, that was a legitimate thought at one point last year. And this year it's like, you know, Dwayne Morgan might not play. And a, you know, 40% JUCO three-point shooter might not play ever.
Yeah.
So
I think that's the biggest, looking at just snapshot right now, preseason, like, that's the biggest difference for me, is the, they'll have the depth that maybe they can't keep guys fresher. Maybe that will translate into better late game defense and a few more wins on the ledger. Those are all ifs, but I mean, that's what we're talking about right now.
With Rashad Vaughn and Chris Wood, they've both had some NBA workouts. The ones that I've seen, and I'm sure there's other ones, but Rashad Vaughn has worked out for Indiana. He's supposed to work out for the Lakers, or no, he already did work out for the Lakers, and he and Chris Wood both worked out for the Suns on Friday, and I also saw Chris Wood worked out for the Blazers as well. I'm sure there's a few more, but none of those teams are, well, the Lakers are picking 27th and the Blazers 23rd, but otherwise the Pacers are 11 and the Suns are 13, so only two of those teams aren't anywhere near where Rashad Vaughn and Chris Wood are projected at the moment. Moving on to Mountain West non-conference scheduling for basketball. This is from the Idaho Statesman. Craig Thompson basically said that there were going to be requirements for multiple sports in terms of scheduling. You know, who you can schedule, who you can't schedule, and stuff like that. But in basketball, you know, he had a quote in this story from the Idaho Statesman, and I'm not 100% sure what he was meaning, but I think I know. But he said, quote, "We'd send four or five teams to the NCAA tournament by increasing one game, like when we had the challenge in the past." And the challenge he's referring to is the Missouri Valley Conference challenge that they will be taking part in this upcoming year. So I hear that quote, and what I think he means is basically, if we replaced every team's worst opponent with a Missouri Valley opponent, then our strength of schedule, our RPI, our KenPom number as a whole would rise enough that the Mountain West would get more respect and would be able to send four or five teams to the NCAA tournament. That sounds a little crazy, right? A little optimistic.
Yeah, it's swapping out one game is going to have that big of an impact on the league as a whole. I mean, I haven't crunched the numbers, but it seems like it would take more than that to elevate, to make it a conference that is consistently getting four and five teams into the NCAA tournament.
So if you take last year, they got three in. One of those was Wyoming because they won the conference tournament, and Colorado State wasn't far away. They weren't the next team out, but they were. I don't even think when the NCAA tournament committee released their thing, they weren't even in the next four. I think they were after that somewhere. But they were certainly a bubble team and not far. So if you had every team, or 10 of the 11, since only 10 play in the Missouri Valley, if you had 10 of the 11 teams take out their worst game, substitute in a Missouri Valley team, like, would that be enough to rise the overall strength of schedule, raise the overall strength of schedule and RPI and KenPom of Colorado State to move them past five teams? Like, when I put it that way, it doesn't sound as crazy.
I get like I guess I think that I don't know. Tell me what to think. I don't know.
So,
I honestly don't know what to think here.
So it's one game is like, you know, 3% of your schedule or 2%, something like that, of your entire schedule. So it's like it's not going to make a dramatic impact, but the way RPI is figured, your opponents and your opponent's opponents matter. And so if you had your whole conference undertake this, now you're talking about 11 games, you know, that could be a noticeable difference. But if you actually – I went through and looked at every Mountain West team and their worst Division I opponent by KenPom rank, and then basically just said, okay, if they took that game away and replaced it with a Missouri Valley team that they're supposed to play this upcoming year, like how big of a difference is that? And on average, the difference between the worst team in KenPom rankings and the Missouri Valley opponent was 166 places.
That's significant.
That's significant. Now, remember, it's only one game, so it's about 3% of each team's schedule. But I do feel like if every team in the conference, because, you know, you're looking, UNLV played Southern Utah. They were 306. Wyoming played Florida A&M. They were 350. You know, Air Force played the worst team in KenPom, Grambling State, who was 351. I think the best worst opponent was Colorado State played 262, which was Missouri State, who's actually in the Missouri Valley Conference. But basically, everybody played an opponent that was 250 or worse in KenPom. Most teams played a team that was 300 or worse. So if you just take out one of those, replace it with you know, Missouri Valley, you've got teams like Wichita State that are 10, but then Illinois State was 56, and Evansville was 103. So you've got some teams that aren't great but are decent
You know, you don't have to replace them with juggernauts. You can replace them with your run-of-the-mill Missouri Valley teams.
Yeah, and like to me, when I looked at that, and it was 166 is the difference between Mountain West worst team they play and who they play in the Missouri Valley, I think it makes a difference. I don't know if it gets Colorado State in. I don't know if it moves the numbers enough that the Mountain West gets a little bit more respect. But I think as a whole, because Wyoming played four teams that were KenPom 320 or worse, plus they played one non-D1 team. So Wyoming played five teams that were atrocious last year. Like five of the worst teams you could possibly schedule. UNLV played two teams like that. So if you had every team basically get rid of those games. So UNLV doesn't play Southern Utah. Instead, they play, you know, an Evansville-type team. And Wyoming doesn't play four of those games. And Boise doesn't play two or three of those games. And same for UNR and Air Force. That's when it really starts to make a difference. If they can come in and say, listen, you're not playing a team from the SWAC. You don't get to put Grambling State on your schedule.
You certainly don't get to put four of them like on your schedule.
Yes, that's when I think it really would make a difference. So I like the idea of sort of the schedule requirements and the idea that, hey, you guys can't schedule those terrible teams because at the end of the year we look terrible because our numbers are so low. I think it would make a difference if they were able to get, you know, every team to drop, you know, all but one or all, if they could, of those just awful opponents. I think it would really, really help. Just doing one would be, you know, a slight increase, but not a huge one by any standard.
Is that going to be something that the coaches are going to accept gladly? Getting rid of these games that are just basically rubber stamp victories?
I think so. Dave Rice, Steve Fisher, I think those two guys probably wouldn't have any issue with it at all because those two teams can kind of schedule whoever. New Mexico can get, you know, good games as well. But I think Wyoming would have a problem with it because who's going to play a road game in Wyoming? Like that's part of the reason why they've got four Florida A&Ms on their schedule is because they're not getting decent teams, a lot of decent teams, to come to Wyoming for a non-conference game. Like, it's just not happening. So Wyoming would have a problem with it. You know, Colorado State could probably, they can probably handle it. Boise might have a problem, even though they've been in the NCAA tournament two of the last 3 years. Their football program gives them some notoriety. You know, they probably still have a bit of a scheduling issue for basketball as well. So I think the sort of the elitist in the conference wouldn't have an issue, but those teams that are kind of in the middle of nowhere, they're going to be like, well, we're only going to be able to play three home games in the non-conference because we can't schedule terrible teams and good teams aren't going to come to us.
So then what's the next step? For if these are going to be requirements, how do you enforce that?
I don't know.
How do you enforce it league-wide?
Kick them out. You just, what do you do? You fine them? Is that what you do? Can you do that?
I have no idea.
Can you, they were just announcing all the, how much the Mountain West is paying all its members for the bowl payouts and NCAA tournament and TV deals. Can you just fine them? Give it to somebody else. If you schedule 400-300 plus teams and somebody else doesn't, they get your cut.
I guess you may possibly, like, the withholding, like, your league payout is something that you could do. But I like the idea of raising the floor for the scheduling league-wide. Like, I like that. That's a good idea. That's something that, I guess, the numbers, like you quoted the numbers, they show it over the course of the season. Replacing, like, one game may not matter, but replacing multiple games, if it's going to make a difference, like, if the Mountain West is playing all these 350 ranked teams, like, then that's what your conference, like, sort of becomes associated with.
Yeah, and
like, if you're playing those teams consistently, you know, three times a year, four times a year, like, then that becomes the competition for your league.
Yeah. Some of them, I won't say can't be helped, but kind of can't be helped. Because, like, if you take Boise State, for example, they came to Vegas and played in, I don't remember the name of the tournament, but played in one of the tournaments at the Orleans in the non-conference. And tournaments like that, UNLV, they had some of these games as well. Basically, there's like four teams that are in the major part of the tournament, but then there's four bad teams that are in sort of the minor part of the tournament. And so Boise State, they played Abilene Christian as a part of that deal. Like, you say, okay, we're going to come play in this Las Vegas tournament and place three good teams, or two good teams, but we're going to have to play two bad teams at home because that's how the scheduling works out. So they had to play Abilene Christian to then therefore play in whatever tournament they played in here in Las Vegas. So some of them, it's like, well, if you're going to play in this tournament, you have to play that team. But I think as a whole, you can say you can still make it sort of a, I don't know, some sort of requirement that, hey, if you're going to play in the tournament, it's kind of okay, but you can't just go out of your way and grab Utah Valley and play them.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think it helps, and I think if you're the Mountain West, if you're the Mountain West in basketball, your goal, and probably in football too, your goal is to be the best non-Power 5 conference, right?
Yeah, you want to be a mid-major leader.
Yeah, to me, that should be their objective, and I think this helps that. And you're not going to be the best G5. I guess it's not G5 in basketball since there's 37 conferences or whatever. But be the best non-power conference. You can't schedule Utah Valley, Abilene Christian over and over and over. You just can't do it. You're not going to get the respect you need, and you're not going to get the numbers you need when it comes to KenPom and RPI and strength of schedule.
So you're saying that a league official has a idea for the league that is actually a good idea?
Absolutely. Yes, it's a great idea. The SEC actually did this a couple years ago where they didn't actually put in requirements, but they made every team send in their non-conference schedule for approval. And I don't know, like, I haven't heard of a story where somebody sent it in for approval and the conference said, no, you can't play this. But at the very, like, even if you just said, hey, we have to approve your schedule, that would at least make coaches think like, oh, maybe I shouldn't schedule this because the conference is going to get mad at me or the conference is going to punish us somehow because this is a crappy schedule. So I don't know. But yes, it's a good idea. And I think it would help a lot in terms of making the Mountain West, because they finished like 13th at a conferences in KenPom this year and like 10th in RPI.
Which is bad.
Yeah, you can't finish that low. I mean, there was a couple, like, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, the Mountain West was third in RPI and, like, second in KenPom. Like, they were like, oh, this is a really good conference. They're not a Power 5 conference, but they're still really good. Like, you fall all the way down to 13th. That's pretty low. On to recruiting, two guys. We'll start with a guy that probably is not going to mean anything for UNLV. That's Dikembe Dixon. He's a 6'7 small forward from West Virginia. John Rothstein tweeted about a week ago now that he was going to be visiting UNLV on June 15th, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Dikembe Dixon himself tweeted that he was going to announce on Wednesday, which would be before June 15th, and Mike, apparently you heard that his visit might be canceled as it is. So
yeah. Did a little digging. It looks like he's not coming. And it seemed sort of it was kind of surprised. The thing that surprised me about that was he was 2015 when it looked like UNLV was, you know, pretty much done with the class of 2015. They do have one open scholarship, but I didn't expect that to come from the class of 2015 because, you know, the door is still open for Justin Jackson possibly to reclassify and come a year earlier. So that's still on the table. But that was like my biggest question with Dixon was how it was going to affect like Justin Jackson. And just the timing and being such a late adding such a recruit so late in the process, even though it's not super late, the summer hasn't even really kicked in yet. But that seemed a little bit surprising to me.
Yeah, fun fact, he is the same age as Rashad Vaughn.
Yeah, it seemed like they were, it's sort of the opportunity popped up for Dixon being available, and they took a little look, and it kind of didn't work out.
So the guy that could actually come to UNLV in the class of 2016 is Skylar Mays, a point guard. I know you talked to him. He's got a connection to Jordan Cornish. You still continue to tell me that they're going to need a point guard after Jerome Seegers leaves, even though I think it should be Pat McCall. But tell me about Skylar Mays.
Skylar Mays is like 6'4", point guard, more of a – he says he's a pass-first point guard, but from what I've seen, it seems like he's an AAU ball anyways, a little bit of a scorer. He takes the ball to the basket. But, yeah, like a long, rangy point guard, not a great outside shot yet. He said that's something that he's working on. He'll be in town this weekend for an official visit. He's from Louisiana. He said that he's good friends with Jordan Cornish and that they talk a lot. Cornish has vouched for him, you know, to the coaching staff during his recruitment. So that's happening this weekend. And it sounds like they actually have a pretty good shot at Mays. It seems like Dixon kind of came and went. Didn't really seem to heat up that much, but Mays seems like is someone that they have a real chance at.
Jordan Cornish is a guy that on the UNLV roster that if he said, hey, this is a good player, the coaching staff probably listens to him, right?
Yeah, I think he's proved that he knows enough about the game to, you know, game recognize game. I think they...
Let's go. Top three guys that they would listen to and the top three guys they wouldn't listen to.
You're talking the best future scouts?
Yes. Yeah, so if we're top three, if they came to Dave Rice and said, hey, this guy's good, you should recruit him, which three are they are most likely to listen to?
Let's see. I think we might have to separate them into, like, position. Like, I think if Ben Carter told them that there was, like, a big man that, you know, he was impressed with, that would carry some weight. I think Cornish, and I would say I think McCaw probably has the – from what I've seen, the highest basketball IQ on the team.
All right, bottom three. Who are they saying, thanks, but no thanks?
Probably it would be three people in the media.
No. I want three players.
I don't know. I think, but, apparently Cornish is the guy who turned them on to. They knew who he was. They were, you know, recruiting him, but Cornish, like, vouched for him, you know, said that he knows him, he's a good guy. So they're in the mix now. He's coming out for an official visit. And I think the point guard is a spot that could use another body. Like, Mays said it, that's, you know, part of their pitch to him is that Seager's gone after this year. So Mays' freshman year would be 2016-17. And he and Jalen Poizer would be the only, you know, point guards on the roster. You would throw Pat McCaw into that mix. But, yeah, so, I mean, as it stands now, Poizer is the only point guard scheduled slated to be on that team.
If Steven Zimmerman says, I'll come back for year two, but you have to sign this kid, they do it, right?
What kid are we talking about?
It doesn't matter.
Anyone?
Yes, anyone.
Well, they do have an open scholarship spot.
I think you have to do it. If Steven Zimmerman says, yeah, I'll give you year two, but you got to bring on my buddy, like, absolutely. No doubt about it.
I don't think they would.
I think you've got to.
I think, no, I can't, like, Dave Wright, I think he's, like, got enough conviction that I don't think they would do it. Because that sets such, like, the precedent that it sets. Like, you can...
The precedent it sets...
You can be a player's coach, but you can't let the players run the team. You can't have a situation where LeBron is your best player, and he's also your coach, and he's also your GM. Like, all that's working for the Cavs right now. But that's you can't do that. You can't let the players, like, run the team.
I know you can't. Like, it doesn't set a precedent. It sets a precedent if you're 7 foot and a five-star and from Las Vegas and everybody's favorite player already, even though you haven't played for UNLV. Like, yeah, if one of those comes along again, yeah, you can kind of dictate terms.
But here's the thing. UNLV, they recruit at a high level. What if there's a class where they can get two five-star seven-footers and both of those guys want to bring, you know, their best friend along for the ride? Then what do you do? Are you willing to burn two spots? What if you can get three five-stars that are willing to come? What if you have a chance to bring in a historic recruiting class, the best in program history? You get three five-stars, but they all want to bring along, you know, their entourage, their best friend. Like,
bring them and kick somebody out. Say, sorry, you got to transfer. It happens. I'll do it. I don't care. Yeah, if you can get top 10 talent, absolutely. What is Zimmerman? What's his national rank? Like 11, 12, 9?
Yeah, he was as high as 2 at one point during the season, and then I think he finished up at 10 or 11 or maybe even 9.
Yeah, if you can get top 15 guy, yeah, you can bring whoever you want. You get a plus 1 to the program. That's how this works. That's as good as it gets. All right, so Skyler, man, I'm telling you, at the end of this year, you're going to be like, they don't need a point guard. Pat McCall is going to be here.
It wouldn't surprise me. I think he can play the position. It's just from what I saw last year, like it seems like they like him off the ball.
I like him dribbling the ball in his hands, not off the ball, but whatever. All right, moving on to curling the stash, bullet points of the show. Derek Jones dunked over 5 people in what he said was his last dunk contest before coming to college. 5 is more than 4. Supposedly one of those 5 was 7 feet tall. Is he still the second best dunker to Ike Wamu?
Dunked over.
Team?
I haven't seen the 5-man dunk yet. I think the last one.
You
I
haven't?
Saw, when was that? I saw the 4-man dunk.
It was just recently.
I saw the 4-man dunk at the Mary Klein Classic.
Yeah, it was 5. No,
oh,
it was 5.
Was it 5?
Yeah, it was
okay,
5 people.
Okay, I know.
Because he like one-upped himself from whatever the hell he had done before.
Okay.
Yeah, is he still second to Ike?
We're going to have to see, like, when they get on the floor.
I am going to ask you this every time we see him dunk, just so you know.
I'm going to... 1A...
No,
1A.5B.
A is ahead of B, so whoever you put in 1A is actually just 1.
Yeah.
Just so you know. Moving on, UNLV won the Governor's Series for the third straight time, 27-21 over Nevada Reno, closest margin that the schools have had in the Governor's Series. The All-Mountain West first team, as decided by Phil Steele, who everybody loves Phil Steele, Devontae Boyd and Penny Vea were both named to that, but I think he named 4 teams, and I think it was only 4 UNLV players on any of those spots. So they had 2 first teamers and then like 2 fourth teamers, so that's sort of indicative of being 2-11. Women's basketball got a transfer. She won't be eligible this next year, but will be the year after, from Arkansas, and she's 6'4", named Katie Powell. So they have a 6'4" player that'll graduate after this next season, so they'll be replacing her with another 6'4" post player. All right, now we're going to talk some football, and I'm going to compare Randall Cunningham to Blake Decker. This is probably going to be favorite thing I've done on any of the Tell Boy episodes. So Randall Cunningham.
Wait, how are you going to do this? You're going to do like a tale of the tape, or are you going to give me?
You'll find
okay.
out. Come on. But Randall Cunningham, he's one of 72 Division I players. There's some non-Division I players on it as well. On the ballot for the College Football Hall of Fame, he's listed as a punter because you have to have been named a first-team All-American to be eligible for the College Football Hall of Fame. He was not named a first-team All-American as a quarterback, but was as a punter. As far as I know, they'll take into account what he did as a quarterback when determining if he's a Hall of Famer or not.
Nice loophole.
Okay. Yes, that would be, yeah, whatever. That's weird. I don't know. Hall of Fame, I don't know, whatever. But I'm going to give you Randall Cunningham the average game based on his three seasons at UNLV, and I'm going to give you Blake Decker's average game based on his one season at UNLV. You ready for this?
Go.
Randall Cunningham, on an average game, completed 18 of 30 passes. Blake Decker completed 18 of 31 passes. Randall Cunningham threw for 237 yards per game. Blake Decker threw for 222.
Clear advantage for Cunningham so far.
Cunningham threw 1.7 touchdowns per game. Decker, 1.2. Cunningham threw 0.85 interceptions per game. Decker threw 1.4 interceptions per game. Now, the other part of what quarterbacks do, and that is run the ball. This does include sacks, because all quarterback rushing stats in college include sacks. But Cunningham, 9 carries, 6 yards per game. Blake Decker, 11 carries, 28 yards per game. Cunningham rushed for 0.2 touchdowns per game. Decker for 0.4. Now, on a per-play basis, Randall Cunningham averaged 6.3 yards per play, Blake Decker 5.9. Randall Cunningham scored a touchdown every 20 plays, Blake Decker every 28 plays. Obviously, Cunningham is better. He's got a slightly better completion percentage, 15 more yards a game, half a touchdown, half an interception less, not as good of a runner,
I mean,
but did produce more yards.
Half an interception per game is a pretty wide mark. That's a significant number.
Yes, but my question to you is, Randall Cunningham is on the Hall of Fame ballot. He is the best quarterback in UNLV history, and it's not close. But his numbers are not significantly better than Blake Decker. Like, those numbers, like, you would take Cunningham's numbers, but it's not like, oh, this guy's going to lead us to, you know, 8 wins, and this guy's going to lead us to 2 wins. Like, it's kind of like, they're pretty similar.
Some of that, I would imagine you'd have to wait for the era. You'd have to wait those numbers for the era that they played in, because I think the passing game has become much more sophisticated and much more effective.
But hasn't defense as well?
I don't know. I'd have to.
Like,
we just had a
run where, like, the SEC won them all, because I think they won 7, and 6 of the 7 teams that won it had, like, the top 5 efficient defense in the country. Like, we just had a run.
But comparing 2 UNLV players, I don't think they're playing SEC defenses every week. They're playing, you know, UNLV opponents. I think that you'd have to wait. Obviously, I can't even believe I'm debating this as if it's an actual argument, but. You have to wait those numbers for the era, for the, like, I feel like, and obviously the one that's massively skewed is the rushing stats, because, as you said, they take sacks into account, which, just use it. I know we both are statistically minded people, but I'm going to use that old chestnut that if you just use your eyes, you'd have to give Cunningham a slight advantage in the running game. Even though Decker's numbers are better, I think Cunningham is all around slightly, maybe a better runner.
Listen, I have no clue whatsoever how good Randall Cunningham's offensive line was, but it couldn't have been much worse than what Blake Decker had to deal with.
Can Blake Decker jump over a man? Can he jump over a human being? Which I've seen Cunningham do that.
You don't necessarily get points or yards for jumping over someone. There's a good chance you'll get more yards, but it's nothing that's good. Automatically translate.
You can win dunk contests that way.
You can, absolutely. But, see, so here's... Because I've done this before with two different quarterbacks at Ole Miss. I compared Archie Manning to Bo Wallace. Bo Wallace had better numbers. Old Ole Miss fans didn't like
well,
that.
Well, Archie Manning is and always has been overrated, but continue.
By far. It's not even close. But, you mentioned that the passing game is more sophisticated, and I think it is much more sophisticated, and that is to me, that's a big reason for the completion percentage. Because, I mean, Cunningham, 58.1%, his career completion percentage. Like, that's okay, but you're not a great quarterback if you only complete 58% of your passes now in college football. I mean, Decker completed 57.6. So, like, you're... Like, that's not good to only complete 57%, 58% of your passes. I think the passing game is more sophisticated, but it's like, I don't quite get how Randall Cunningham's numbers are, like, the same as Blake Decker's, except for, like, interceptions. I don't get it. I don't quite comprehend how a bad quarterback on a 2-11 team can put up the same numbers as a potential Hall of Fame college football quarterback. I guess he's
you
a
might have to look
punter.
At their career arc also, because I'm not sure. I know Decker came in. He's played 2 years at a junior college. He was a starter there. He threw a ton of passes. So he comes in, you know, somewhat polished in his first year, whereas I'm not sure about Cunningham. I'd have to go back and look. I wasn't, you know, I didn't follow UNLV football at the time. I was barely alive. But I don't know if he came in and played as a freshman and it took him some time or what. But I bet if you just took his, you know, his junior year numbers compared to Decker's junior year numbers, it would be like the margin would increase a little bit between those two guys.
I think Cunningham's best year was his junior year, statistically. I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but I think he had his fewest interceptions and most yards passing his junior year.
And it's just even back to like the 80s, for football, it's just hard. If you watch a college or NFL game from like the 1980s, which is not that long ago, it just looks like a completely different game, especially with passing. Like it's
like high school football.
It's two receivers running out. It's a quarterback taking like a 12-step drop. Like it's nothing that you see in today's game. And they're just like taking a huge drop back, and then they're standing there and they're just launching it downfield. It's just different.
Anyway, if Randall Cunningham is in the Hall of Fame, Blake Decker deserves a nomination as well. That's the point of this part of the show.
Since Cunningham didn't qualify as a quarterback, what position do you think that Blake Decker could qualify to become a first-team All-American?
I think he had like three tackles last year, so maybe linebacker. he has more career tackles than Randall Cunningham, just so you know. So he's got that going for him. Okay. It's a little bit more about football. There is a wonderful man named Dave Bartu. He has a website called the College Football Matrix. And what Dave does is he predicts every college football game in March and April. And he used to have them all on his website. Now he has an app, and you got to like download the app, and you can get them on there. The app's really cool, but it's less convenient than just going to his website. But I've talked to Dave a lot before when I did Ole Miss podcast, and he's a wonderful radio guest. Probably doesn't care very much about UNLV though. But his UNLV numbers for this year, how many wins are they going to get, Mike? You tell me.
I guess considering that two is basically the magic number, I'm going to stick with two wins.
That is what Dave Bartu has as well. He has them beating Idaho State, and he has them beating Hawaii. What Dave Bartu does, and he predicts every game, and he's got like an 80% winning percentage or correct percentage, whatever, in terms of his predictions. And he's a lot better at the Power 5 schools than he is at the G5 schools, because the talent disparity is less in the Power 5 than it is in the G5. But basically, he takes three things into account: your talent, your coaching, and where the game is played. And the talent is the big one. So he ranks every team 1 through 100 and what is it, 22 now, in terms of talent. And he does it based on recruiting rankings and attrition are his two big things. So he'll take an average recruiting ranking number. I think he tweaks them himself for what he says are bias. I don't know. And then he also works in attrition. So if you had, you know, a really good class, but half those guys didn't qualify academically for their sophomore year or something, like your class gets diminished a lot. That's the big thing. Then coaching, if you have a team, like UNLV is supposed to get 2 wins. If they win 4 games next year, then their coach effect is going to be +2 for the next season. So it's basically saying Tony Sanchez is a good coach. If they don't win any, it'll be -2 and Tony Sanchez is not a good coach. And then the last one is home field. Basically, if you're equal to the other team, it's whoever has home field that's going to win the game. So beating Idaho State, beating Hawaii, UNLV has a worse talent rank than everybody on their schedule. But if you go through their schedule, they're going to lose their first 3 non-conference games, Northern Iowa, UCLA, Michigan, probably not going to be close. Northern Illinois one might be. They'll beat Idaho State, probably not going to beat UNR, probably not going to beat San Jose State, probably not going to beat Fresno State. All three of those teams have good plus coaches. Boise State has way too much talent for UNLV, but then the last 4 games of the year is where it could get fun, because Hawaii has a little bit better talent, but they're a -3 in terms of coaching. So they lose a lot of games they shouldn't lose, and that's why he has UNLV beating them. Then they play Colorado State. Now, Colorado State's 101 in talent. Did you fall asleep, Mike?
No, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay. Is this riveting? I know numbers are great on radio and podcasts.
No, I'm intrigued by the simplicity of the deciding factors.
It's awesome. It's a wonderful simplicity.
Is he picking now? The question I have is, you say he's like, you know, if he's got an 86% success rate, is he picking straight up? Is he picking against? He's not picking against the spread like this.
No, yeah, he's just picking winners, and then. He'll give like a, I think he gives a score. If you ask him, he'll give you a score.
What do you think, if you were to do this, the same exercise before the season, predict every college football game, what percentage would you reasonably expect yourself, without doing, you know, a ton of research, you know, like looking up the teams and the games that aren't, but what percentage would you expect to hit at without having a magical formula?
65. Like there's a lot of games, like UCLA is playing UNLV. Like there's a lot of games that it's easy, but like UNLV and Hawaii, I don't have a clue who the hell's going to win that game. So like I think I would get more than half, because you have a lot of cupcake games, but I don't think I'd get 70%.
Yeah, I don't think so either. It's tempting to say like you could just pick Alabama to win every game, and then they'll win 12 of their 13 games, so then you're right there, you're over 90%, but there's just so many games between the bottom two teams in a conference, or teams, just middle of the pack teams in non-power five conference that I know nothing about. That's the thing that amazes me about Las Vegas and gambling, is all the time, like, because you could take, and we know people like sports writers or whatever, and you'll ask, they'll just be having conversations about two random college football teams that are playing this weekend. And I have no idea. It's like, you're talking a different, like, I have no interest in, you know, Tulsa versus, you know, Marshall but people seem to, they know who's playing, they know who's playing quarterback, they know the point spread, they know like everything about these games. I have no idea.
So the last 4 games are the fun part, because they're projected to beat Hawaii. Colorado State is slightly better in talent, but it is an away game, and their coach effect is +0.5. So probably not going to win that one. But then San Diego State comes to UNLV. San Diego State's got better talent, but they're -2 in coach effect. So potentially you could grab that one if you're UNLV. And then the last game of the season is at Wyoming. Wyoming's 111. That's one spot higher than UNLV. Their coach effect is 0. The only reason that he has Wyoming winning is because it's at Wyoming. But that's a game that's essentially, I mean, it's as big of a toss-up as you can have in terms of how he ranks games. So that, I mean, you could very easily win that game if you're UNLV. So there's 2 games they probably should win, and then there's 3 more that I kind of look at and say they could get that one. They probably won't get all 3, but I think there's, you know, a 3-win, 4-win possibility.
In two of those possible wins are the final 2 games of the season.
Yeah.
So say this team, you know, has 2 wins, you know, which is already the benchmark basically for this program. And then, you know, they win those, let's say best case scenario, they win those last 2 games of the season. All of a sudden, it's a 4-win season, and you're closing the year with 2 victories. Is that enough to get people excited and, you know, pumped up for, Tony Sanchez and UNLV, this new era of UNLV football?
I think it would be.
Me too. I think that, like, after you watch a team win two games, like, 4 out of 5 years, you bring in a new coach, and then they – I think that would be enough to get people fired up about next year.
Yeah, if they – you know, because the way this kind of projects, they would beat Idaho State, but they would be 1-7 going into that Hawaii game. When they're 1-7 and only have beaten Idaho State, there's going to be, you know, a decent amount of, well, nothing's changed. But I do think the expectation for this year is nothing is going to change win-loss-wise. I think Tony Sanchez has the expectation of, like, beat Idaho State, and that's it.
Yeah, I think, like I said, the fan base, what fan base there is, it's like when two wins is the average. Like, that's
it's amazing how many times they've won two
games. No one is expecting miracles. No one's expecting him to come in here and be, you know, play above 500 or anything like that. I think most people expect another baseline season. Football is there's how many players are on a college football roster? I mean, you've got like 100 players. Like, it takes time to turn that over and to sort of get everything in place. It's not going to happen in 1 year. Especially when it's pardon me for saying it, UNLV football fans, but for a teardown project, essentially, when the program is so bad for so long that you basically have to tear it down and start with something so outside the box as hiring a high school coach who's trying to completely revitalize recruiting and facilities and all that stuff. I don't think anyone expects it to be a 1 or even a 2 year turnaround. So, like, if they go winless this year, I don't think it would be a huge. I don't think that anyone would be calling for Sanchez to go or anything like that. I think that there really is no floor for this season. Like, there's no floor of expectations.
Idaho State's a pretty decent FCS team. I think they won. It's either 8 or 9 games they won last year in FCS. So they're not awful. It's a successful football season. Yes or no? It's a successful football season if they beat Idaho State, win a Mountain West game, and lose to UNR by less than 21. Like, those are like the three biggest things that could happen next year.
So they're gonna win the Idaho State game. Like, in terms of win losses, I think that's fine. Like, I think that's. I don't think the success is gonna be determined by wins and losses. I think it's gonna be determined by the recruits that they bring in. Like, are they gonna land any, you know. Are they going to land any talent with, you know, stars next to their names? Are they going to get big Bishop Gorman prospects? Are they going to, like, own the Las Vegas Valley? Like, are they going to make inroads in California? Like, that kind of stuff is more important than the product that they're going to put on the field, you know, for 11 games this season.
All right. Though they got a Hall of Fame quarterback, so probably should win more than 2 games.
Well,
but,
Hall of Fame punter.
All right, end of the show. I'm going to complain about something today. Mike, do you watch tennis at all?
I watch big matches.
All right, so the French Open, they played that tournament on clay. I like tennis. Don't love it, but I like tennis. They play that on clay. Tennis has the best review system in all of sports.
Fact. Absolute fact.
It's not even close. It's quick, it doesn't delay the game, and it's 100% right.
You know why it's the best? It's because humans are not involved in any way.
Yes. But they don't use it at the French Open because it's a clay court, and the ball leaves a mark on the clay court. So instead of using their wonderful review system, they have their chair umpire, whatever it's called, hop down out of their chair, run over to the spot. They point down, and then the other player points with them, and they're like, oh, there it is. Look, is there any space between the line? I don't know. You tell me. And then the umpire makes a ruling and waddles back to his chair, and it takes longer than the actual review system that they have, and it's not 100% accurate because I was watching a tennis match. The ref came down and made a call on a challenge, and then the TV, I think it was the tennis channel, showed what would have been the review system, and they got it wrong. First off, I don't know why the French Open doesn't use it. It's incredibly stupid not to use it. But more importantly, I don't know why tennis doesn't use it in real time. why do they have the eight? I think it's ten. No, it's yeah, it's ten linesmen, line judges, whatever the hell they're called, that sit there and yell out. Why do they even have them? Just make it real time, and when it hits, when it's not in play, make a buzzing noise or a beeping noise. Like, and there you go. It's you don't have challenges. It's never going to be wrong. You don't have to pay 10 guys to stand around. Like, I get, like, you know, lower levels of tennis or lower tournaments might not have it, but for the French Open, the U.S. Open, the Australian Open, like, all the big events, like, why don't we have this? Like, that seems too smart. Like, that should be a thing. Now, to take that into a different sport, which is baseball, if you watch a baseball game on ESPN, and like I think the Padres broadcast does it too, they have the K-Zone, and they show it like it's on the screen for every pitch, and you can see if it was a strike or not, and you can see when the umpire messes up. Why the hell do we have home plate umpires calling balls and strikes in Major League Baseball?
I think you need the umpire there in case there's a play at the plate.
Like, yeah, he can be there. He just doesn't need to call balls and strikes.
My argument is you have the technology, arm the home plate umpire with some sort of buzzer, like a handheld buzzer. When it's a strike, you buzz him. If it's a ball, you know, you let it go. So that, and then you let the machine make the calls, and the ump can just, if you want him out there for aesthetic purposes, you know, in real time, you relay the call to him, and then he just makes the call verbally. Like, that's...
It's... Like, baseball's not going to do it for like 40 years because it's baseball.
I got to tell you, I don't like the baseball replay system. Like, I don't like replay. I try to be a forward thinking like sports fan. So a lot of replay I do like. I liked it in the NFL. I love it in tennis. I don't like baseball. I don't like replay in baseball.
But you would be okay with my real time K-Zone.
Real time strike zone is different. Plays on the bases. Okay. It just feels very wrong to watch a player slide into a base, and then you have to wait 5 minutes before you can celebrate, whether he's safe or out.
I like it. Replay is good, because replay, well, it doesn't always, but replay improved the calls on the field from like 95% to 99%. So I will like replay, even if it slows stuff down. I'm okay with it. But I am all for... No umpires, referees in any sport. Like, probably can't do it in basketball and football because there's too much movement and contact and whatever. But for tennis and volleyball and baseball, like, if we can have, like, technology or robots, whatever you want to call it, making these calls, why don't we have that? I legitimately don't get why you, like, if it's too damn expensive, okay. But at some point in the next 5 years, it's not going to be too damn expensive for Major League Baseball to have a real-time K-Zone tell their home plate umpire if it was a ball or a strike.
I agree. I think they could do it right now if they wanted to, if they really wanted to.
Yeah, and same with tennis. Like, they could do the same thing. And, well, there's not important volleyball, Olympic volleyball maybe, but nobody cares about other volleyball. But, like, it just blows my mind that I can watch ESPN show me K-Zone and watch when the umpire gets it wrong. Like, just absolutely blows my mind that that's a thing. Like, why Major League Baseball wouldn't say we should use this just is incredibly dumb to me.
I'm on your side. I feel that this is valid annoyance. Like, yeah, you're valid in feeling this. You know, why not just go adopt the PGA rules and just go to the honor system? Just let the batter or the catcher call their own balls or strikes.
You know what's crazy is college tennis does that. Because, like, they don't have umpires. Like, you call in and out in college tennis.
And it works, right, for the most part?
I mean, I don't know. I should talk to some tennis players, because I'm sure there's some tennis players that are like, no, there's a douchebag from San Diego State that won't call anything for
me. And I'm sure there'll be players that say, like, hell yeah, I call all my shots in. Like, I call everything that's close. I call out for them, and I'll take all those points.
Yeah, I guess I get it, because you have six matches going on and you can't get 10 lines judges and an umpire for all of those matches, but it just is like, holy shit, they call their own. That doesn't seem smart, but that's how it is. I imagine if there was a player with a reputation for that, like the coaches would be like, hey, tell your guy to stop being a douchebag. Like, I'd imagine that's where it would kind of come from. But you, at some point, you can't have it. Like, if a kid's just a douchebag, he's just going to be a douchebag.
Some people are fueled by that. Like, if they're,
yeah,
if they like being like the negative attention or being like that kind of aggravating personality. So,
but anyway, more computers,
robots
to call
everywhere.
Things. Yes, listen, it makes too much sense. Like, there was it was the NCAA football. 1 year, and I'm sure Madden did it too, they put in the game where, like, the refs would get calls wrong and you could challenge it. And I'm like, no, this is stupid. This is a video game. Just get it right. I know you can get it right because it's a video game. Like, that was the dumbest thing ever in a video game, that I would have to go challenge something because I didn't get it right.
Agreed.
Like, that was, like, I think that was just a ploy to make you think, oh, I'm going to challenge this and get it wrong 97% of the time.
They're building inadequate refereeing into the games, into the artificial intelligence of the games.
I mean, listen, I guess it's...
I know people want realistic games, but that seems like... That's like more realism than I need.
But, okay, French Open needs to get there. They just need to not be stupid, like... Their replay system takes a shorter amount of time than it takes for the umpire to get down there and point in the clay. But, anyway, he's Mike Grimala. I'm Tyler Bischoff. Go Internet. Go Technology. Take over sports. This has been the Towel Boys. Thanks for tuning in.